Welcome to Alaska Edition, a weekly public affairs program produced by Alaska Public Telecommunications Incorporated in the studios of KAKM.
Hello and welcome to Alaska Edition. I'm Lori Townsend, sitting in this week for Michael Carey, who is away. And each week on Alaska Edition, we bring together journalists to discuss the news items of the week. Joining me this week are Eric Adams from Alaska Dispatch. And hi, Eric. Thanks for being here.
Thank you.
Also, Jacqueline Estes, the news director at KNBA Public Radio here in Anchorage. Hi, Jacqueline.
Hi.
Thanks for being here today.
Good to be here.
And also Daisha Eaton, who is the KSKA Metro reporter for Anchorage area in South Central Alaska. Thanks, Daisha, for taking time to be here today, especially on your day off. I appreciate that. The governor held a press conference this morning to talk about the salmon fisheries disaster. We don't have a lot of information about that yet, but I do know that he had Cora Campbell will be the commissioner of Fish and Game, will be putting together a task force to look at this. Apparently Fish and Game biologists have said that they have been aware that there's been a problem for quite some time, and they're going to be looking at it. The governor did say he committed to set netters that he would make sure that they would be able to make a living, if that means fishing for other types of fish. They're going to be working on that and looking into seeing what they can do. We'll get more information on that as the day progresses, and of course we'll have something tonight in Alaska News Nightly, and as the weekend goes on we'll know more. Yesterday there was a large case that came forward that started out as an investigation into cocaine smuggling here in Anchorage and widened quite quickly into a massive tax fraud case involving about $19 million. Eric, has Alaska Dispatch looked into this at all?
No, we haven't covered this story, actually. We did go over the indictments and the charging documents yesterday in the newsroom. What's known for certain is that undercover Anchorage police officers purchased more than 50 ounces of cocaine from a few of the suspects. That drug investigation somehow led federal prosecutors to unearth tax fraud by what Alaska U.S. Attorney Karen Loeffler called, quote, an organized crime ring, unquote, operating in Alaska. The suspects, so far as I understood, were legal and non-legal immigrants from Mexico and Central America, and a corrupt Wells Fargo Bank employee who helped to facilitate the theft of nearly $19 million from the federal government. And most of that money was sent to the Dominican Republic and wire exchanges, and the charging documents made mention of actual, I don't know if they were like people carrying money down there, or they made mention of these physical movements of money. So the documents were really interesting. They had all the makings of a great crime movie. And that's about all we know. The attorney she didn't get into the specifics of how the local police investigation into drugs evolved into this tax fraud case. So,
you're right, it does sort of read like a movie script. There were identities of people, they had several aliases, people that they had taken social security numbers of people living in Puerto Rico and using those to set up false accounts here in Anchorage with the help of this employee of the Wells Fargo Bank, who was the only U.S. citizen involved. And then part of the scheme was to get checks delivered to residences here in Anchorage and Eagle River and then intercept that mail. So apparently they were quite busy scurrying around collecting checks out of mailboxes. A total of $19 million, but I guess it's uncertain yet how much of that actually they had filed for that much. But it's not quite clear yet how much money actually was paid in those false returns. So an interesting case that I'm sure we'll know more about as the days progress. Thank you. The election that never ends in Anchorage, Daisha, sort of like this zombie election that won't go away.
Yes.
More than 100 uncounted ballots were recently found. What's the latest with this?
Well, 141 uncounted ballots. They were sample ballots, apparently, and they were in a, for lack of better words, closet. Now, in an assembly meeting room in the base floor of City Hall. And somehow they were overlooked. What happened was apparently those are supposed to be separated out from the ballots that go through the voting machines. And instead they were just tossed into a bag during the chaos of election night because they were running out of ballots. And this was something that a lot of workers at the polls had never encountered before. And somehow when they recounted things, they just were left inside of a sealed bag. And so they kept all of the election materials in that closet. And not a particularly secure room, to be honest with you. I went down and took a look at it, and it had windows on, you know, two walls to the outside, to the street. It didn't have a combination lock on the door. Just another thing that makes you go, possibility of a lot of problems with this election. But how they found the ballots, and this is promising for the municipality, is that they were actually moving all the election materials up to a secure locking room with a combination lock that's fireproof on the same floor as the clerk's office, actually in the clerk's office. So there is hope that the municipality can straighten things out. But this opens up a whole other can of worms. They're going to have to recount these ballots. It's not going to change the election, it's clear. You know, these were wide margins. But, you know, they have to be official about it because there were so many problems with the election. They're going to recount those 141, see what they say. And then they're going to have to recertify the election. So they'll be taking a few more official meetings about this for sure.
Well, and certainly just the damage to the credibility of the whole process. There's already been so much fallout. There was a firing of the deputy clerk, the resignation of the clerk. And do you expect more fallout? Is there any suggestion that there may be still some other people falling by the wayside because of this?
Well, I sat down with Ernie Hall when I went up to take a look at the new room in the clerk's office where they're keeping all the election materials. And he said, you know, this is terrible. This is the worst thing that could have happened to us at this point. We thought we were just getting past this election and trying to, you know, improve security, get better people running the clerk's office. I don't sense that there will be more fallout. I think they've kind of axed the people they want to get rid of. They're bringing in new people. They're in the process of hiring a new deputy clerk. That should happen any day now. They have the new clerk on the job. So I think they're trying to turn over a new leaf. However, this does extend the lack of credibility for a little bit longer, and I think they will be living in the shadow for a while to come. But hopefully they can turn around the corner pretty soon here. Hopefully there are no more ballots.
Yes, and the process will be much more streamlined and cleaned up going forward. Eric, you're an editor at Alaska Dispatch these days, but in your life as a reporter, you covered politics in a lot of states and cities. Have you ever encountered anything like the mess that we saw with this Anchorage municipal election?
Well, elections can be messy. Any sort of human endeavor, there's a margin for error. And having met with
that's kind of not what you want to hear.
Well, having met with and spoken to these city employees, I mean, you kind of just have to shake your head and feel sorry for them to an extent. it is a story that won't die. That said, I came back to Alaska and to continue my career, having worked in Portland prior to coming here. And in Portland and in Oregon, voters vote by mail. It's very simple. It's very elegant, almost. And actually, almost every single problem that was that City Hall encountered on election night would be solved like that if we all just started mailing in our ballots. The vote counting would be probably something to consider, but it certainly, I don't recall any problems with any sorts of incompetence in terms of election vote counting in Oregon. And perhaps it's something the city should study and consider once the dust is settled and any last shopping bags or sealed bags or what have you of ballots are revealed and counted and everyone has actually gotten to exercise their constitutional right to vote.
Well, that's interesting that all the voting is done by mail. How do they certify that the votes that are being mailed in are actually coming from registered voters?
You register with the state in the same way that you would in Alaska, with the Department of Motor Vehicles or mm-hmm. with the state
I believe it's office. The same in Washington State. That's how I was familiar with voting before I came to Alaska, and it's sure solved a lot of problems. And as spread out geographically as Alaska is, I think it would make a lot of sense here too.
It's like absentee vote. Think of absentee voting as the general election vote, right? I mean, absentee voting, you mail in your ballot early, or you show up to an election station early. If you're an overseas voter in the military deployed somewhere, you get a ballot, and you go through all of the steps that the state requires to certify and make sure that you are who you say you are. Washington State just this week announced that they were going to start allowing voting via Facebook.
We're not quite there yet.
We're not there yet, right.
I see a lot of problems there.
There are a lot of, and that's something, let them play with that
you
for a couple years.
You can just like the candidate is the one of your choice. Yeah. Is that the idea?
Maybe have your photo tag to confirm it's indeed you and that you are voting.
Oh, my goodness.
But, the mail-in ballot, you don't pay for a stamp. There are actual places around town. There were places in Portland where you could just sort of drop off your ballot if you wanted to, if you felt like that was a more secure way to make sure your ballot was getting from your hands to the government. You could drop it off at an official place, or you could just put it in the mail.
I loved voting this way because you can sit down with the voter's guide and you can read about every candidate and every issue and really think through as you're making your vote instead of feeling rushed and being in the voting booth or trying to remember what you read in the pamphlet beforehand.
Interesting. Well, thank you for that. We're going to get Jacqueline in the conversation now. The Federal Subsistence Board has been sort of grappling with the low Kenai Peninsula bull moose numbers. This has been an issue that we've talked about a few times. Jacqueline, you covered a meeting of the board this mm-hmm. week, and there was discussion of the severe reduction in the hunt. What are managers wanting to do to address this?
Well, the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service came to the Federal Subsistence Board with a request that it delegate authority to the Kenai Wildlife Refuge manager to be able to close areas during the season if enough moose were taken from there, rather than the way it is now. He can only have an open or closed season. He can't close specific areas. And another option would be to make a special request to the board to do something. But that would take a lot of time, probably weeks.
What do we know about why this is happening?
Well, it's really interesting. Evidently, years ago, there was a lot of browse or food for the moose. And because the ecosystem is changing, there's not as much food as there used to be, and they were allowing the harvest of young bulls, and the ratio of cows to bulls became skewed to where there were not enough bulls, and so they shut down, and the numbers were low. So last year they reduced the harvest by 92% from, I think it was 400 to 40, from 400 down to about 40 or something like that. And only 4 moose were allocated for subsistence users. Mm. And so they came forward with this request to delegate authority. Now, a little process issue came up in that regional advisory councils, who are the people who are on the ground and users, are asked to review all these proposals that come before the subsistence board. And this proposal went to the South Central Regional Advisory Council, but they didn't act on it. The chairman just sort of made a statement that I don't think we need to take formal action because we've never opposed anything like this. But when it got to the Federal Subsistence Board, they've been criticized for not giving enough weight to the recommendations of the regional advisory councils. So they were talking about not acting on the request from U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service until they got a formal or official recommendation from the RAC. But they decided to go ahead and delegate the authority to the refuge manager with the provision that if the RAC or the state or a tribal council objects to them having that authority, that they would come in and request the board to revise or revoke it at their January meeting.
Has there ever been a suggestion that they should have a hunt for cows? I know that in the Midwest, when it comes to white-tailed deer, which of course there's, you know, they're almost like mice, there's so many of them, there's oftentimes an additional hunt where they will issue tags for does. Was that raised at
all? It's really different in the Midwest because they don't have predators like we have here, and they don't, and they have those vast cornfields.
That's true.
And the deer are so, they're well fed. And in on the Kenai, the overall population is down. So if they allowed a harvest of cows, that would affect the overall population and bring it down. And they don't need it to go any further. And they made that 92% cut because they want to get the population back to a healthy cow-moose ratio and to a to healthy numbers as quickly as possible.
So has the decision been made then? I'm wondering about the impact mm-hmm. on subsistence users for this season. Will there be just no opportunity for harvest for them?
I don't know if they've set the harvest level. So I think it's going to be hard on everybody. Mm-hmm. I think they're still going to have a... And actually, Andy Loringer, who's the Kenai Wildlife Refuge manager, said that he thinks they're going to need a management approach focusing on conservation for the long term. So this isn't something, even though people have said there have been wildfires and that, you know, in not too distant past, that will increase the amount of browse and food for the moose. It's not going to, the situation, the low numbers isn't going to turn around quickly.
Absolutely. These things definitely take time. The State Health Insurance Exchange, the Affordable Care Act, was recently upheld by the U.S. Supreme Court. They did some tweaking with some of the things within the law itself, but generally upheld it. The governor, Sean Parnell, has said, let the feds handle this exchange idea rather than the state doing it. He says they can better implement their own mandates. Eric, first, let's talk a little bit about what the exchanges are and what they're supposed to do. Critics say that we'll be left out of subsidies if the state isn't involved. What's your take on this?
Well, the governor said it wasn't in Alaska's fiscal interest to create and maintain a health insurance exchange. That was in a press release sent out by his office, by the governor's office this week, based on an analysis of the project, the actual creation, the concept of an exchange that was undertaken, paid for by the state, that revealed that exchanges would not be self-sustaining, that it would not, that this project, the exchange market would actually end up costing Alaska money to maintain. You could presume that there would be staff workers involved to maintain the information on the exchange. And basically what the exchange is first of all, it's not meant to make money. So it never was meant to be a way for any state or any partnership of states to make money. Rather, they're meant to save money for consumers in the long run, and the state, for that matter, to save on healthcare costs. They're meant to offer consumers and business owners a portal of sorts where, for the first time, you can shop for and compare health insurance plans in the same way that you can go to like Expedia.com and compare different flights to Denver, or eInsurance.com and compare different insurance plans and options for cars in Alaska. So that's a very general sort of idea of what the exchange is. It is a regulation. It's a type of regulation that under the Affordable Care Act that ideally and with the law, the Congress's intent was for the exchange to make health insurance providers more accountable to us as consumers of health insurance. And in 2 years, whether we like it or not, we're all going to be consumers of health insurance. It will be federal law that it is federal law that we all have insurance by at some point in 2014, or risk paying a penalty. So the exchanges make health insurance providers more accountable to us, to our more accountable to our employers who create our work insurance plans, to the many self-employed Alaskans shopping who will be shopping for insurance if they don't already have it. Now Alaska's opted not to create one. What does that mean? It means that health department regulators and analysts in Washington, D.C. essentially will be creating a model exchange, a federal exchange model that will then be sort of tweaked and modified based on lots of insurance data and actuary analysis and all kinds of number crunching, and that federal model will then be applied to Alaska, and the federal government will be on the hook for paying for that. That could be a good thing. It could be a bad thing. We don't really know. So far as I know, Alaska is the only state in the nation that did not apply for funds to conceive of a health insurance exchange. Mm-hmm. So even the other 25 states that sued against healthcare reform as unconstitutional, they all applied for the money anyway. Florida, Texas, all these states, they went ahead and said, hey, we should go ahead and start looking at this. So
part of what the Supreme Court did say was that states could opt out of the expansion of Medicaid if they so chose. The governor is weighing whether or not he'll allow that expansion under the Affordable Care Act. He said that today he's leaning toward not doing it. About 30,000 additional Alaskans would be eligible. The governor is concerned about the long-term cost. It does seem like there's a lot that's unknown yet about what this will mean. The idea is not that somehow costs are going to go down as much as just holding them from rising quite so rapidly.
I mean, in essence, that would be costs going down if they're not rising. But just to step back, one more thing I did want to say about the exchange is that just because Alaska doesn't create one doesn't mean that we're somehow penalized under Affordable Care Act, that somehow the other benefits or other rules of the law will not apply or that will somehow be weighted against us. Small businesses will still be eligible for tax credits for their employees under the federal insurance exchange.
Sure.
You know, some states have explored creating regional exchanges, like I believe Washington and Oregon have explored creating an exchange where the insurance companies and insurance providers that work in those separate states can now work over state lines to create a broader pool of insurance applicants in order to bring costs down. So it's really a market-based sort of approach to, you know, the bigger the pool, hopefully the smaller the cost, right? And that's another fundamental of the exchange. It works, but that wouldn't necessarily work in Alaska, I don't think. We have really high costs, the highest costs in the nation for medical care, for health care, and for health insurance. I don't think that there are any states that we could find as natural allies in creating an exchange.
Yes.
You know, Parnell may decide to reject the Medicaid expansion, and like you said, that would offer 30,000, maybe more Alaskans, and that's just initially, access to medical care and preventative treatment and health awareness that comes with having a family doctor.
Right. I wanted to ask you, Jacqueline, what's known about this possible expansion of Medicaid and how that may impact the Indian Health Service?
Well, in exchange for lands and resources that were taken from Native Americans, the federal government promised to provide health care to Native Americans, and it was for a long time it was done through the Indian Health Service, and the services that were provided through that department were they only had the money that was allocated to the Indian Health Service. So a law was passed that allowed tribes to contract with the federal government and take over Indian health delivery of health services. And when that happened, they were also allowed to start billing Medicare, Medicaid, and private insurance companies. And so that brought a lot more money into the tribal health care system. That the Indian Health Care Improvement Act makes that permanent, and that's part of the Affordable Health Care Act. So
the Medicaid decision, it could be the biggest, single biggest decision of Parnell's administration in terms of immediate impact on thousands and thousands of Alaskans. So it'll be really interesting to see which way he comes down on that decision.
Well, as in most cases when I'm hosting this program, it's been a fantastic conversation, but we didn't get to nearly half of what I hoped that we could get to discuss today because we're already out of time. Thank you so much, Eric Adams from Alaska Dispatch, for joining us. Jacqueline Estes from KMBA and Daisha Eaton from KSKA. Michael Carey will be back next week. Thank you.
If you have questions or comments about the program, you can email Alaska Edition at alaskaedition@alaskapublic.org or write us at 3877 University Drive, Anchorage, Alaska, 99508. Alaska Edition is a production of KAKM. The opinions expressed are those of the host and guests and do not necessarily represent those of KSKA, KAKM, the licensee, or their underwriters.